Caldwell, amongst others. Hopefully, we'll convince you why Caldwell and Holmes felt so good about the consistent history of interpretation of Ecology. It's not an interpretation of quantum mechanics, but the interpretation of quantum mechanics. That's a tall order, and came to hear your lectures. Our Griffiths is a professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Is it Pittsburgh proper or the outskirts? And she's working on history since the 80s. So with that, let's welcome our speaker.
I'm grateful for being invited. I thank Dr. Emerson and the Perimeter Institute for hospitality. I'm very happy to be in the new building, especially since a year ago I visited the old building, which was founded by Frank. I have up here the first of my, they were transparencies, and I told them to prefer to have the original. So here they are.
By the way, Chris mentioned your book. So,
yeah.
Dr. Griffiths brought a copy of this book, which will be available downstairs with the receptionist. And you can refer to the book, you can take it out, and I guess load copies of all the pages. Other copyright issues with that, probably, if you're pulling copies of the pages. Or
I don't think anybody will worry about that. Part of it is actually available on the web, the first 12 chapters, as indicated here at this particular place. That was a sort of compromise with the publisher. Of course, the publisher prefers to keep as little as possible on the web, so we don't buy a copy. The author prefers that the first be disseminated just as much as for the rather small royalties which the publisher offers. So there's a bit of conflict of interest there, and we settled on 12 chapters. We won't bring any points. Now, I'm told that you like to ask questions during the lectures, and let me say I would appreciate that. It tells me that you are still awake. It helps keep me awake. If things get too out of hand, I will suggest that we continue the discussion of this or that topic afterwards. But my own feeling is that if one person feels that something is vague and unclear, that there are 15 others who feel the same way, but perhaps don't have the courage to raise the point. So please, if you have difficulty following things, or do raise questions, and I will try and address them. Well, as you can see from this first of my slides, I believe the conceptual difficulties in quantum mechanics come from introducing probabilities in the wrong way. Let me say that I started off my career not in quantum foundations, but in statistical physics. So probabilities have been part of my life. It was when I was asked to teach a course in quantum mechanics that I discovered that probabilities were handled rather badly in the textbooks. And this led me to develop an approach in which I believe probabilities are introduced properly and in a consistent way. Now, not only do I think this is significant for its foundational issue, I also, in the course of my career, have tried on various occasions to apply quantum mechanics to some system, you know, inelastic scattering of neutrons from a solid. What should they tell us about the excitations? And in doing so, I felt very frustrated because I didn't think that I understood how you apply quantum mechanics to this particular situation. Some people are not bothered when they end up in that situation. I was very much bothered. And I'm happy to say that whereas I don't understand a lot of things about the farming world. At least at the present time, I have considerable confidence in how quantum mechanics should be applied to any particular problem, whether it's familiar to me or something I haven't bumped into before. I know what the principles are and how you should carry out the arguments. And I have even a few tricks for approaching these problems, of which I will not have, however, much time to speak here. So, the history of histories is very brief. I started off in the first publication in 1984, on this in 1987, Gell-Mann and Harley in 1990, and there have been numerous publications since. The most recent one relevant to these lectures, anyway, is my book on consistent and proper systems on theory. What will the history's approach do for us? Well, for one thing, it will resolve paradoxes. Sometimes I use the term change rather than resolve, because I think the paradoxes contain lots of interesting ideas. They illustrate how quantum mechanics is different from the classical world, and for that reason, one doesn't want the paradoxes to disappear. The most vast viewpoint is the fact that we lower the employment opportunities for physics. But nonetheless, you don't want those paradoxes to be things which keep you up late at night work. You want to be able to approach them, to say something sensible about them, to say, I understand them, very interesting stuff, but basically we are on top. Probably you know a number of these paradoxes. In these lectures, I will say something about the double slit and about Einstein, Podolsky, and Wilson. Time prevents speaking of a number of other paradoxes. I remark that the Harvey paradox is named for a long-term member of this institute. And then the blank down here is the challenge. I don't know any paradoxes that I can't handle in these methods, so I would welcome some suggestions or proposals. So if you think there's something that these procedures will not be able to handle. Let's then consider the double slit paradox. Here at the left is the slit system. As you know, a particle comes up through the slit system in a wave, passes through, and then goes on to the detectors at the right. I imagine these are detectors of the modern kind that detect a single particle at a time. The horizontal bars to the right of the detectors indicate the counting rates. So this is a high counting rate here, and this is essentially zero counting rate down here. And the counting rates indicate an interference pattern, and the interference pattern is tied in to the difference of the distances from the two slits to the detector in question. This clearly indicates that we're dealing with some sort of wave phenomenon. And it also indicates that the wave or particle or whatever it is coming through the slit system is coming coherent to the slit system. The particle has to know, so to speak, that both slits are there. Otherwise, you can't get an interference pattern. On the other hand, and this is where the mysteries begin, the particles come through one at a time. If you lower the intensity, and this has been done in various experiments, the interference pattern persists. So one believes that it's there if you send through one particle every second. The particle, when it comes through, ends up randomly at one of the detectors, where the probability is finite. Let's say this detector is zero probability, so it ends up at one of the others, but which detector it ends up is random. And it is this randomness that's characteristic of quantum mechanics. It is this randomness that requires us to put probabilities into quantum theory. And so it's this randomness which will be the center of the things I will be speaking to you about. And I'll tell you at the beginning that the consistent history approach takes the attitude that the randomness is an intrinsic part of nature. It is, in this point of view, anti-Einstein from the start. The probabilities are there because that is the way the world is. Attempts have been made to ascribe these to hidden variables. But that's not the consistent, history approach, as you will see. Hidden variables are quite deliberately excluded from the discussion. In the standard textbook, such as the one I have been using this term in my guide to the course at Carnegie Mellon, I use Cohen Tanucci et al., very well written textbook translated from the French. In typical textbooks, including this one, randomness is introduced in quantum theory through measurements. And it's my opinion that this approach to introducing probabilities, whereas it was historically necessary, it's hard to imagine the subject having developed without something of that sort in it, is now an impediment to understanding. And therefore, when I use this textbook, I explain to the students that there are better ways of handling probabilities, and I explain to them what these better ways are. In the history's approach, measurements do not play a fundamental role. Instead, the randomness is intrinsic in quantum mechanics. Measurements are simply examples of physical processes. Now, quantum mechanics, we believe, I believe, not everybody believes, applies to all physical processes. We live in a quantum world. We no longer live in a classical world. There is, I believe, no classical part to the world left. This opinion is not totally, well, Tony Leggett, the Nobel laureate, used to believe that there must be a sort of classical part to the world. I think he has backed away from that. Osher Paris, who died quite recently, maintained always that there must be a classical part to the world. This also seems to have been part of Bohr's philosophy, although Bohr you can sort of interpret in various different ways. I am no expert on that. In any case, the history's perspective is that there is no classical world. Everything that we see around us is fundamentally quantum mechanical. That includes the apparatus, which participates in measurement processes. If we want to understand what goes on in measurements, we need to first understand quantum principles, which apply whether or not there are measurements present. And once we understand the quantum principles, we can apply them to measurement apparatus or anything else. And there's nothing special about measurements. The same principles that work elsewhere work in measurements. What about classical mechanics? Well, classical mechanics is just a good approximation to quantum mechanics under certain circumstances, in particular when you have lots of people here. The issue of why classical mechanics is a good approximation in certain circumstances, and the discussion of those circumstances, these, in my opinion, are quantum questions. These are things we answer by using the principles of quantum mechanics, applying them to complex systems, and seeing what happens. Okay, let's then go to discuss the double slit and take up the paradoxical elements of it and say something about the history of it. First, let me say I put up here the experimental exposition. I actually did experiments at one time as a student, set up a detector with a collimator in front of it, So I know how one thinks about things and those circumstances. Experimentalist, when he sets up his detector, believes that the particle arrives or doesn't arrive, that's the case for me, but let's say that this detector triggers. The detector triggered because a particle arrived just before the detection. The particle was approaching the detector, and that. The consistent historian says that good experimentalists know what they're doing. And the triggered detector does indeed indicate the arrival of particles, and the description which the experimentalist gives is correct. Correct quantum mechanics. It has, to be sure, its limitations, and the task of the theorist doing quantum mechanics is to explain what some of those limitations are. But it is not to try and explain it away. Theorists should not bully competent people. Then let me proceed on. Let's modify the double slit experiment and put the detectors directly behind the two slits. This, of course, is difficult if you're doing something, if you're using light. It is feasible if you use the corresponding experiment for neutrons. And if you want to do it with light, what you actually want to do is a slightly different experiment. Let me switch ahead in my notes and put this slightly different experiment up here and indicate sort of what the comparison is. Here is a Mach-Zehnder interferometer schematically. How many of you know what Mach-Zehnder is in the culprit? Everybody. So here is the initial beam splitter, then a pair of mirrors, as you know, then there's a second beam splitter, and then here are the detectors. I draw this beneath the double slit just to indicate the analogy which I have in mind. You see the two arms of the Mach-Zehnder correspond to the two slits. So if a particle goes through one slit or the other slit, I think of it in the Mach-Zehnder circumstances going through one arm or going through the other. If I put a detector directly behind, or detectors directly behind the slits in the Mach-Zehnder, those detectors sit inside the arms of the interferometer. Or the detectors in the interference region of the double slit are those in the Mach-Zehnder which occur after the second beam split. So at some points I will be a bit sloppy with discussion of double slit. And when I am sloppy, if you want to have the unsloppy version, you will need to translate it back to Mach-Zehnder. But one of the particular points here is that Mach-Zehnder is sufficiently large that there's no trouble putting detectors in the separate arms. And it's from that point of view, or with that excuse, one could say, that I asked you to consider the situation in which the detectors are placed behind the two slits. What happens in this circumstance? Well, the counting rates here are the same. And what happens is that either one detector triggers or the other detector triggers. They don't trigger in coincidence, assuming the counting rates are sufficiently low. The experimentalist understands that by saying that the particle comes through one of the slits or through the other slit, and the detector which triggers indicates which slit the particle came through. This sort of thinking is used in the design of collimator, shielding, and so forth, which is used in actual apparatus. So this is the experimentalist explanation. The quantum textbook explanation tends to be to say, well, we cannot discuss what happened before the measurement. We can't say it. This is the great smoky dragon picture, which Wheeler so loved to talk about. The historian, as I say, the consistent historian, supports the experimentalist account, although I should have to add in some modesty that there is also a way of drawing the Great Smoky Dragon picture and coming to a sort of similar conclusion to that. I will show that to you in due course. But since the radical claim here is that the experimentalists experimentalists are sensible people, I stress that that is what that is the conclusion if you apply the history's approach. Well, we have the setup just about ready for the paradox. So, let me see if I'll get my slides in order here. Okay, paradox. Double slit paradox, there are various ways of doing the paradox, but one way you can do it is the following. You can say, all right, in this case, suppose we have our detector behind the slits, and we've concluded that in that case, one detector, the other will trigger, and the particle came through the slit just ahead of the detector which triggers. On the other hand, you told us earlier, you're saying to me, that if we go out to the interference region and, for instance, observe that no particle ends up in this detector, that has to be because, so to speak, both slits are in action. Now the trouble comes if you say, well, suppose at the very last instant we take the detectors and push them out of the way. At the very last instant. When perhaps the particle has already entered the slits. Now you're saying the technical difficulties. For technical difficulties, replace it with the Mach-Zehnder system I showed you earlier. Well, you say Mach-Zehnder protons are moving rapidly. Then take Wheeler's attitude towards the Mach-Zehnder. If you've read his discussion of the delayed choice experiment, he simply takes light from some distant galaxy passing through some quantum gravity lens, and he has plenty of time to take the beam splitter out of the way or leave it in the way, as the case may be. So you see how the paradox is one you're right. If the detectors are here, then you say, well, all right, the particle came through one or the other slits. On the other hand, down here, the detectors are pushed out of the way, trying to get this interference pattern, so the particle has got to come through the slit system coherently. And then if you follow up on Wheeler's reasoning, you ask yourself, well, you know, does the future influence the past? This is the sort of thing. Does the particle, you know that you're going to push those things out of the way, and therefore it decides that it will come coherently through the slit system? There's another way of doing the double slit paradox, by the way. I don't have it on my transparency, but it's almost as much fun. And in this case, the particle comes through one of the slits, but sort of knows whether the other slit is open or closed. So either the future influencing the past or nefarious non-local influences are conclusions easy to arrive at in terms of the double slit experiment. As a consistent historian, I support neither of these. Neither that the future influences the past, nor that there are non-local effects. And I will show you in due course how I get around these particular things. But before I do that, I need to introduce you to some other ideas and technical things. Yes?
Did you just say you don't accept non-locality?
Definitely, yes.
Okay.
Oh, good. I'm glad some people are awake. Okay. Now to start off some technical issues which will be important for understanding the history of books. I want at this stage to compare classical and quantum mechanics. Classical mechanics with the phase space, think of a harmonic oscillator if you want, and quantum mechanics with the Hilbert space. The descriptions have some similarities and some striking differences.
for the classical particle, you know, it's positioned at any time, or sorry, it's state at any time, it's just a point in the phase space. Whereas if you go to the Hilbert space, the state is not a point, but it's a line, that is, it's a ray. At least I will take this attitude, that the state in the Hilbert space always described by a ray. And this, by the way, I'm following von Weiss. This is not particularly consistent history approach. You will find all of this in his famous or infamous book. I tell my students, by the way, that this is a great book, and if they want to consult it, they should go and get the original German edition, because the printing is much better. And even if they understand very little German, or in fact none at all, they will do about as well with the original edition as with the English translation. So on the Hilbert space, we use rays. Then, so I've just spoken of a physical state of property. It's the next thing I need. Property, I think of as a collection of points. So think of something like the energy being between, you know, two Earths and five Earths, or the position being in some particular range, or things of this sort. In the classical case, these are represented by regions in the phase space, a collection of points where the property is true. In the quantum case, the property, what you want for a property is a subspace of the Hilbert space. If you have an infinite dimensional one, you want a closed subspace, but we'll deal with finite dimensional ones. Yes.
So you sketch your two-dimensional Hilbert space, and in this case, of course, the denoted the ray with this written B. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that's a physical statement, and properties are subspaces. So physical states are always right one projectors, and properties can be non-right one projectors, is that?
Yes. Everybody knows what projectors are?
Okay, I see.
Right.
So
Is there anybody
who
doesn't know what a projector is?
It might be worth reviewing.
Oh, all right, fine. Well, projector is an orthogonal projection operator. And what it says, the projector onto the state P, the curly P, it does the following. You take a point in the Hilbert space, and you draw it perpendicular to the drawn line on the P. That's operation is projection in this case, and you can imagine it in higher dimensional space. It's just the same thing. You take the point in the Hilbert space, drop it perpendicularly onto the surface representing the subspace. It's clear if you apply the projector twice in a row that it doesn't do anything the second time. Because the object, if P squared is acting on something that's already in the plane, so that the projector, when acting on the subspace itself, is slightly different. Is that okay? So, where were we?
The distinction between the dimensionality of the subspaces associated with physical space and properties. You said physical states are rank one projectors, rank one subspaces.
Yes,
and properties can be any dimensional.
That's sort of by definition. In other words, I wouldn't hesitate to use the term property referring to a one dimensional subspace, but it is the one dimensional subspace that's the closest analogy to a point in the classical case. And then these higher dimensional subspaces correspond to collections. Okay. Now we need to do certain things with logical properties, and so the negation of a property is very important idea. So the negation of the property P is a property which, in the phase space, consists of all of the points outside. Outside the region. In the quantum case, the property corresponds not to all the Hilbert space outside the property in question, but to what's called the orthogonal complement. Orthogonal complement is a subspace of the Hilbert space consisting of all of the vectors which are orthogonal to the original, to the original one. Here I just have a one-dimensional P, and therefore, well, and P perf is one-dimensional because this is a two-dimensional Hilbert. Yes.
So, if I could ask an example, if you were talking about, for example, the energy of a system, you would consider basically having the ground state energy would be fairly simple. It would be just that particular eigenspace. You would consider not having the ground state energy to not include superpositions. You would only consider it to be the other energy eigenstates.
I thank you for raising the point. But let me start with simple example. Let me say something about spin a half to start off with, because it's two-dimensional, so it's sort of simpler. But then remind me to get back to the energy question. Okay, spin a half particle has a two-dimensional Hilbert space. The spin is two-dimensional. And we represent the ray by actually a point on the block sphere. Have people dealt with block sphere, Joe?
Sorry?
Have people dealt with block sphere? It's not crucial to what goes on. If you know about it, it helps. So use it as a hook for future. It's two-dimensional but a complex Hilbert space. So you cannot represent it quite the way I cheated in the previous graph, right? It was a real two-dimensional space. Complex two-dimensional space is obviously bigger, harder to think about. And the way the specialists think about it is they take the rays and they map those rays onto the surface of an ordinary sphere. And they do it in such a way that if a particular point here is on the sphere, then the orthogonal complement is the antipode. What am I dealing with here? SC equals plus a half is the state of a spin half particle. It's the north pole on the block sphere in the usual arrangement. SC equals minus a half. It's a negation of S equals a half because it's the antipode, the south pole on the block sphere. So it is the orthogonal. Each ray in a two-dimensional Hilbert space has simply, there's only one ray that's orthogonal to it, and this is correct also in a complex Hilbert space. So negation then means for the spin half particle, the negation of the property of SC equals plus a half is SC equals minus a half. And then you either have the property typical of the classical system, also quantum system, that either the property or its negation is true. And therefore, either SC equals plus a half or SC equals minus a half. And we typically do not know which is the case for a particular particle. You can find out by running it through a Sternberg apparatus arranged in such a way as to measure SZ. So let me then get back to the energy question. The question was, all right, suppose that the property is that the system is in its ground state. What is the negation of that property? The negation is that the system is described by the subspace of the Hilbert space and by all of the other energy eigenvalues, energy higher than the ground state. This doesn't mean that the system is in a well-defined energy eigenstate, because it could be in a superposition of energy 2 and energy 3. Does that answer your question?
Actually, I originally meant to say the state of the other energy eigenstates. I'm just curious what you would say of a state, for example, which is in a superposition of the ground state and a different energy eigenstate?
That state is certainly possible, but it's not in either in the subspace defining the property of Ganwood, nor the negation of the property, and therefore it's an excellent illustration of how quantum mechanics is seriously different from classical mechanics. Let me get back to the two-dimensional case, which illustrates this, I think, even more graphically. So compare these two plots, Hilbert space and Phase space. Here is the property P, and its negation all points outside. So the space itself is covered by either property P and its negation. Put them together, every point in the Phase space is in one or the other. Compare here the Hilbert space. Here is P, and here is its negation. They're just two rays. Well, they're just loads of rays in the Hilbert space, which belong neither to the property or to its negation. This is a specifically quantum mechanical effect, and one might say that this is the source of all sorts of quantum mechanical woes, troubles, confusions, and so on. Yes.
So would your position be, in part, that logical statements about physical basically, logical statements about physics must correspond to experiments that can be performed?
No. No. My belief is that one should start off thinking about trying to get the logic straight in terms of the mathematics, in the way I will show you. And then argue that the things which are sort of logical nonsense can't be made. I'll give you examples of this. So getting back to my slide from the spin half particle. Well, we started with SC, and it's the negation of SC. If S equals plus a half, is S equals minus a half. And there's nothing special, of course, about the z direction. The x direction is just as good. I always think of rotating the Stern-Gerlach apparatus about its axis, so that I measure Sx rather than Sz if I want to determine the value of Sx. So it's either plus a half or minus a half. It can't be both. And Stern-Gerlach measurement will show which of these is the case. Then we come to the great headache, or not the great headache, but here is where Hilbert space differs from Phase. Oh, let me then comment about what I previously said about the Hilbert space. What I've said thus far about properties and negations is to be found in von Neumann's unreadable book. So I didn't invent these things myself. This is sort of standard thinking, I think not very much emphasized in the textbook, but I don't think it is contested by either. But this sort of approach to it is good. However, we then have the problem. The logical problem as follows. If I take the proposition S equals plus a half and the proposition Sx equals plus a half and join them with a conjunction, and then I assert that this is meaningless. And meaningless in the sense that Hilbert space quantum mechanics assigns it no meaning. That is to say, if I may put my Hilbert space back up on display here, each of the rays here has a sort of physical significance to it. The significance is that there's some direction in space, and the angular momentum has the value plus a half in this direction. There is just no ray in the Hilbert space left over to describe the sort of conjunction that I've been discussing. I brought up Sx equals a half and Sz equals a half. Yes?
If you dealt with them as intersections, which would also be interesting for properties in higher dimensional spaces, wouldn't you come up with the origin in this case? So couldn't you just say that it's not a realizable property?
You're getting ahead of my lecture. I will hit this in just a moment. Very important point. Yes.
So there's the orthodox eigenvaluable. Mm-hmm. You can only assign a property if the system is an eigenstate of that property. Does this imply by that, or is it an extension of that principle?
Let's say that it's in accord with that principle. So far as the ontology of quantum mechanics goes, that ontology being, you know, the things that are there, I very much support this eigenvalue, eigenvector, eigenvector thing. But I think it's not, confusing the two parts. Getting back to this sort of meaningless thing, you see, there's the "and" in there identifies nothing in the Hilbert, nothing in the, except the origin. Nothing in the Hilbert except, of course, that corresponds to it. And therefore, this is sort of not a question of eigenvalue, eigenvector, link, because there's no operator which would give rise to a state corresponding to that property. Okay, then I put down here that, well, I said there's no corresponding arrangement. Then students, at least my students, will tell me that they've been taught that you can't measure this. Have you been so taught also? Okay, I think you've been taught truly, but my comment is the reason no experiment can measure it is that it's not there to measure. Often the distinction between lousy experimentalists who become theorists and good experimentalists is that the good experimentalist can't measure what isn't there, and the lousy one can't. But the reason the good experimentalist can't measure this conjunction is it's not there to measure.
In the case of the normal vector on a unit sphere, one has a z component and an x component, and then the length of the vectors we serve is 1. And it's also classically impossible to have a vector that's both pointing along z and pointing along x.
Right. So they're classical angles of this. But I think the quantum case is really exceptional in the following way. For any classical system, if you give two properties, A and Q, then it always makes sense to talk about the conjunction P and Q. In a manner which I'll begin. The conjunction may be false. For example, let one property be that the energy is less than 1 joule, and the other property that the energy is greater than 10 joules. The conjunction, energy less than 1 joule and greater than 10 joule, clearly false. But false propositions can be meaningful propositions, and that's the next point I'm getting to on my next slide. So let me in fact go, because there's an important logic. Okay. Particular, a false statement is one whose negation is true. So Pennsylvania is a Canadian province, is a false statement. Pennsylvania is not a Canadian province, is negation, and that is a true statement. To be sure, I can imagine that some of us might, one of these years, come on our hands and move straight into Ottawa and say, well, you take this in. But you know, the present time is quite clear for things. I want to distinguish a false statement, because the distinction is very important, false statement and meaningless. A meaningless statement is one that's not formed according to the rules governing the proper use of the language. Here, for instance, is this odd statement, which you can read P and or Q. And if you look at it and say, well, what does it mean? You sort of scratch your head, because it doesn't mean anything. So the distinction, and then it's important to notice that the negation of a meaningless statement is equally meaningless. So this is an extremely important distinction. In classical physical systems, we can meaningfully combine any two properties of an atom. Position is such and such, animal momentum is. And in quantum mechanics, we cannot meaningfully combine everything we want to. What the historians use is, and is only permitted with compatible properties. Compatible properties are those whose projectors commute with each other. So there's a technical condition here. And if you have cases where that condition is violated, such as S equal to half, and as x equals 1 half, those are incompatible. There is no way of combining them with half. And this is one of these very important interpretive rules in the consistent distribution function. This and its extensions. So I need to say something about this. In 1936, George Birkhoff and John von Neumann published a paper called The Logic of Quantum Mechanics. Now, as I told you, it's von Neumann who came up with this notion that negation should be the orthogonal complement of the substrates. Or at least this is something you find in the quote. In The Logic of Quantum Mechanics, and he was quite aware that this gave rise to conceptual difficulties. So in this particular paper, he and Birkhoff take the position that SV equals a half and SX equals 1/2 is meaningful but false. And that, to the gentleman in the center who's questioning, it's just, in this case, see, there are two rays, and they intersect at the origin. The origin of the Hilbert space is a proposition that's always false. So it has some significance. And so there is a sort of nice geometrical way in which they ended up with this proposal, and they started quantum logic. They were quite aware that this was a radical proposal, because once you introduce their rules, you have to modify the rules of logic known as the distributive rules. A and B or C is the same as A or B and A or C. These are very fundamental logical rules. They are fundamental to our thinking. And I believe one of the difficulties which quantum logic has fallen into is that we have very great difficulty sort of modifying our ordinary rules of thought so that we can think this way. My colleagues in robotics at Carnegie Mellon are convinced that in another 10 years, their toys will surpass or at least compete with human beings in terms of thinking capacity. And so I sometimes imagine in my mind that we might get some of our robots to think in the appropriate fashion where quantum logic would make sense. If they do, I have only one fear, namely they may not be able to communicate their insights to the rest of us. Anyway, what consistent history recognizes the logical problem, but then solves it in a completely different way, solves it or evades it, depending on your point of view. The consistent history's solution or evasion is you say this is meaningless. This is relatively conservative, and that the rules of logic remain unchanged. Therefore, we are able to do our reasoning without worrying about this being bothered. However, we do have to mind our P's and our Q's. We have to be able to recognize and exclude from discussion meaningless statements. So that is part of the strategy, is to have a clear logic that works well and which you can understand. However, it is important in using it that you evade, that you avoid certain things which you do very naturally thinking about classical physics and classical systems, namely combining certain ideas, which in the classical world you can always do, and in the quantum world can rapidly get you into it. The way in which on this, and I like to put it, is it's what we call a single framework rule, as a meaningful quantum description uses a single collection of mutually compatible properties, and incompatible descriptions cannot be combined. So, to be specific, for the spin half, we can discuss as it's e. We can say, well, is it plus a half or minus a half, because those are projectors which commute with each other. We can also discuss SX, you know, plus a half or minus a half. That is also permitted. But you cannot combine these discussions. And the combinations which are forbidden are not only the S, Z, and SX, which I've already mentioned to you. Also, you cannot say, is SZ equals plus a half or SX equals plus a half. So the or conjunction, the or logical operation, the and logical operation cannot be placed between incompatible propositions. This is a very fundamental principle of the histories approach, and it is strictly enforced. Yes.
Especially with the two technicals, because we can have a non-contextual invariable model of a fundamental limit space, does that mean this is necessary in fundamental limit spaces, or it's just convenient? I mean, I understand how it's necessary in higher dimensional limit spaces, but is there a way around?
Let me respond as best I can, not being too familiar with the topic, actually. This is simply, the history approach is built up with sort of, you know, like you would try and develop a branch of mathematics with a minimal number of clear and easily stated and fairly well understood things. And therefore, the attitude is, we will need this in higher dimensions as well, surely. But then the clean way to state it is, things don't commute, we don't talk. Now that is basically your conclusion. Okay.
What's happening? And seems clear why, and.
Yes.
But.
Yes. If you take two propositions with or between them, put a negation in front of it, then you put the negation of them with and. Okay, so as soon as you throw out and, basically you have to throw out. All right, so
what if the two operators are, they don't commute, but they only slightly don't commute? But will that be only slightly meaningless?
Okay, well, you're not a physicist. Okay, so basically we try and get sort of the simple things taken care of. And then we sort of promise in the next paper that we will take up the more complicated case. What you're asking is a very very sensible but question to which I can get some sort of answer, but it'd be fairly technical. So let me sort of avoid it in that at the present time and discuss with you later once you've seen a bit more of what goes on. Other questions? Okay, well, I promised you probabilities. You have to get probabilities. So now having done a little preliminary spade work on the Hilbert space, we can go on and discuss probabilities. If you go to a book on standard probability theory, you will find that a probability system, a probability structure, a probability theory consists of three things. I label them S, curly S, and curly E, and PR. test is a sample space. That is very key to all hog farm discussions. A sample space is always thought of as a collection of mutually exclusive possibilities. One and only one occurs in a given experiment. Thus, examples of sample spaces are, for instance, H and T, heads and tails, if you toss a coin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, if you roll a die, etc. Many similar examples. Once you've decided on your sample space, there is an event algebra P. For our purposes, the event algebra can simply be taken to be all subsets of the sample space. And there are cases where you need to restrict your event algebra, and I'm sticking with the simplest cases, which, so far as I know, are sufficient to discuss quantum mysteries. So let's just take the event algebra as all subsets of sample space, and move on to the third item. Third item, labeled PR, is the probability. And in the case under discussion, the probability can be the probability distribution that can be achieved in this way indicated here. To each element in the sample space, I assign number, which is positive, and the sum of those numbers is equal to 5. So this is the structure we need for standard probability. Now, in quantum mechanics, you really have three options. One, you can use the standard theory, which is what we consist in historical truth. You can invent a new one, which is a somewhat challenging task, but one should never discourage the students from challenging tasks. Or the third, which I do not advise, is to become confused, and this, unfortunately, is a very popular option. So, consistent historians use standard probability theory. We then face two tasks. We have to find the sample space, to find the quantum sample space, and we have to introduce the probabilities. Okay, let's then go to the problem of defining a sample space. In the case, the simplest case of a two-dimensional Hilbert space describing a spin. Okay, S equals plus a f and minus a f are mutually exclusive possibilities. If you put an and between them, you find that it is always false. Furthermore, one or the other is true. I'll give you the technical formula for one sense expressed shortly. Experimentally, one or the other is simply a matter of taking the particle that interests you and running it through the Stern-Gerlach definition. What you either get plus f or minus f. And therefore, these two possibilities constitute a sample space. I call it SZ sample space. And it's similar to a bar, right? As it's a two possibility. And then, of course, there's nothing special about the z direction. As x equals plus a half and minus a half, these constitute a second sample space. Well, that's interesting. SZ and SX sample spaces are incompatible. The events cannot be combined. Probabilistic inferences cannot be combined. You cannot assign a probability in one of them and then do some magic to deduce the probability in the other. Yes.
Surprisingly, we're going to have, for instance, in feasible sample spaces that are the same. So, in three dimensions, we have three dimensions, and in two capacitable observables with one dimension. Do you identify the quality of the two different sample spaces?
Let me repeat that just so that it's clear to me and so everybody is, okay? And if you go on three dimensions, imagine a three-dimensional space. You can certainly imagine a situation in which my typical sample space for a three-dimensional Hilbert space will be an orthonormal basis. So let me say that, okay? Everybody's been on the same wave. then you can imagine two orthonormal base fees such that two basis vectors coincide, but then the others are rotated relative to each other. And I think your question is, what do we say in that case?
So you have two solid spaces.
Yes.
But you identify the points in the solid space and the point in the solid space. It's the same quantity.
Well, the same direction is the same property by definition. But I think what you're really asking me is, here are two sample spaces on the way I have discussed sample spaces. Is the consistent historian going to let you move information from one to the other? And the answer is absolutely not. Okay? This is those of you who know something about the Bell-Cotton speculative paradox realize that the prohibition, which I just named, prevents you from even getting started in off in the troublesome direction. Now this is a very good question, and we enforce these framework rules quite strictly. Then let me go on and say something about the general structure of the quantum sample space. General structure, the best way to think of it is a decomposition of the identity. Again, goes back to von Neumann, this concept you will find in this book. So I have a collection of projectors, and the collection of projectors adds up to the identity. Are people familiar with this? Some are, and well, lots. Okay, good.
Maybe we can join the data compliments there. Anybody who's not familiar with that.
But they're never willing to put their hands up. It's like a lot.
So we look at, for one case, the opposite case, and see if there's anybody in the superposition.
Well,
those are the ones that are
very compatible.
This will take us. But let me, for getting the technical stuff, for purposes of understanding my lecture, is not too important. What you really want to have in mind is one or two instances. And an instance you want to have in mind is an orthonormal basis, which you all have evolved, I'm sure. This constitute the projectors onto the basis vector for the basis rays constitute then perfectly good decomposition of the identity, and it's a sort of prototype sentence. You can't do all of quantum mechanics this way. You do need the more general structure. But if you have that basic case in mind, it will give you the idea, the notion that's needed. I add here also a technical issue of what the event algebra consists in, and its projectors, which are sums with coefficients of 0 and 1 of the projectors which form the decomposition of the identity. Okay, take an example. Again, the SC sample space and this language. I say the identity is Z plus Z minus, where and symbol in the square brackets I use sometimes as an abbreviation for a diagram. And so you see there are two projectors here. And the importance of the decomposition of the identity falls to the fact that these projectors are necessarily orthogonal to each other. Different projectors are orthogonal. This means the events are mutual, or the properties are mutually exclusive. So that's important for a sample space, right? The things in the sample space have to be mutually exclusive. And then one of them has to occur in any given experiment. That corresponds to the sum meaningful to the identity. It's that that tells you that you have sort of a complete sample space, a collection of things, one and only one of which is going to occur. And then at the bottom is just this sort of grandfatherly device, namely, before discussing quantum probabilities, make sure you have a sample space. Many quantum paradoxes can be generated by the device of saying, no, don't worry about that, we will take that up later. Okay, but then, you know, some trickery goes on in the air. Okay, so I told you, I'll tell you a little later, follow me next lecture, we'll see, a sort of generalization of the idea of sample space in order to take up histories. But we've hit the essentials of what makes quantum mechanics different in terms of probabilities from classical mechanics. Classical mechanics, you can always use a single sample space. And if people come into you and, you know, student X has chosen this sample space to describe the classical Hermann oscillator, student Y has chosen this sample space, it's always possible to take a suitable intersection of the two, generate a bigger sample space which includes both. Therefore, classically, you never have to deal with more than one. Quantum mechanically, the world is such that we have large numbers of them, they are mutually incompatible, and this is why it is so important to state what your sample space is if you want to reason clearly in the quantum domain. So, from there, I move on to the next topic is assigning probabilities. And I will assign probabilities in a couple of steps. Well, maybe the zero step is to say that once you have a sample, an ordinary probability theory, once you have a sample space, then you go to the mathematicians and say, all right, I've learned this much, now what probability should I use? And they say, we won't tell you. It's up to you, just follow the rules. So X probability better sum up to one, but you know, go out and do experiments and so on. So the mathematics of probability theory does not in itself generate probability. Nor does classical physics in the case of classical systems. Probabilities are deduced by all sorts of means. Typically, they are guessed. And then they are compared with experiments, or they set up a model and so on. All of these techniques will also work in the quantum domain. So I start off with that sort of comment zero. There is, however, a situation in which is unique to quantum mechanics, in that one can deduce certain probabilities for quantum systems using the dynamical laws of quantum mechanics. And this is the sort of probability that I want to get to, because if nature is inherently stochastic, which is what the consistent historians believe, then nature, we hope, will supply us with some law of nature, laws of nature that allow us to assign probabilities. And we believe that that is so. And the first of these laws is found in the Born rule. Now the Born rule applies, as well the other formulas, similar formulas I use, to a closed, isolated physical system. Quantum mechanics can also be applied, of course, to open systems. That is, a closed system is one with nothing exterior to it. Closed, an open system is typically something interacting with its environment. The probability problems are different, both classically and quantum mechanically. If you have a closed system, then you have Hamiltonian laws in both quantum and classical mechanics, which enable you to say certain things which are important when you're assigning probabilities. And the standard route in classical physics is to say, well, in principle, our open system is part of a bigger closed system, and that's the way we will start thinking about it. And that's what I advocate also in the case of quantum systems. So, starting off with a closed quantum system is not to deny that there are open ones, but just to say that this is the route to deriving laws of probability, which should, in principle, apply to both. Okay, so, what is the Born rule? Well, Okay. You say, well, how does Schrodinger's equation enter in? It's important to realize that in the consistent histories approach, the Schrödinger equation is the basis for assigning probabilities. That is its use. Its use is not to tell you how the world develops in time, based on odds from certain people, but it is to tell you how to assign probabilities. Now, it is true that in certain cases, you can discuss, if using certain sample spaces, the world develops in time with probability 1 at each time in a certain state. And this then becomes very close to deterministic classical dynamics, and in that case, the Schrödinger equation can be so interpreted. But in most circumstances in which quantum mechanics is applied and probabilities enter in, Schrödinger's equation is not telling you how the world evolves. Schrödinger's equation is part of the toolbox for assigning probabilities to histories. Let me then explain a bit how this works. Actually, what we do is we use not Schrödinger's equation directly, but we embody it in a time development operator, which I denote by T, some people by U because it's unitary. Depends on two times. And in the case of a time-independent Hamiltonian, is this exponential. And now, which of you have seen time development operator? Okay. So I think that's virtually everybody. So I would go ahead, and you know the great virtue of this, of course, is if you have an intention, you don't have to solve Schrödinger's equation, which is sort of masking and messy. You simply apply this to your initial state, and voila, you have something else. Of course, we have to discuss that something else, which you have. That is the next step. Okay, so I will assume that at some initial time, I have a given state signed up. And then I will consider a later time T1, and at this later time, I will consider a sample space, and the sample space will, for simplicity, just be an orthonormal basis. So I told you what the sample space is. Yes? There's some basis. Born rule will apply. As I understand, Born rule applies whatever basis you want. So you choose the basis, your favorite basis. And we calculate probabilities by the following rule. Probability of this particular state, which Valentine would always write in this form with a condition, and I think his attitude makes sense, but as usual, the condition is frequently omitted when everybody goes like this. That is given by this expression, where you see the time development operator here. And that's where Schrödinger's equation comes in. I have an initial state here, and I have the element basis over here. Now, this probability is the probability of this state, not the probability of measurement. Oh, great stuff. Now, let me say that historians are sympathetic to measurements. If you set up the measuring apparatus properly, you measure what's there. And I will show you the arguments whereby we, at least, believe that you can say that a measurement measures what's there. If a measurement measures what's there, then, of course, the probability of something being there will be revealed in the outcome of the measurement. But I prefer to take the Born rule and start off with what I start off with here. You see is simply this basis set. It's a closed system. And the question is, what is the probability that at time t1 this closed system has this particular property? And this formula is given as you can. Sure.
Yes,
the question.
First is, if the probability is revealing something that exists, then really that outcome occurs with probability 1, not probability given by the Born rule, unless the probabilities given by the Born rule are subjective. Do you agree with that?
By probability of what exists, I simply meant the following, that the probability is part of a theoretical structure. Right, so there's numbers which give efficient assumptions. The attitude, though, is that the numbers are, it's the properties that are real, And so what I'm saying is that in a particular case, I could say that the probability one-third, such and such is the case, at time t1, where two-thirds something else is the case. Does that help clarify it?
Let me try a different question, though. When you say grid measurement for real pre-existing properties, then you figure this is all part of it. So it says the superposition of, say, two box components, and I measure Z, which is going to get up. And you just told us that we can't say that this coherent superposition of two X, if it's in a definite X space, X up, and I measure Z, there's a clear superposition of the Z. And you just told us we could not say for an existing property against Z, because it's got an eigenstate against Z. If you're claiming that when I get Z up, that was a pre-existing property. How do you reconcile those two?
I think probably you should let me go ahead for a little ways in the lecture. And if what I say doesn't clear it up, then let's come back to it. Because these are certainly very, very important questions. The last point I wanted to make on this slide was that measurements, it's not impossible to discuss probabilities of measurement outcomes. Not at all. But what the historian says is then, there is no classical apparatus in the world. Describe your apparatus quantum mechanically. Take a total quantum description of the system. And then let's discuss, all right? And the apparatus, you know, in quantum foundation, the apparatus always equipped with a point that shows us that quantum foundation is an ancient system. And then we can, the historian will tell you how to calculate probability if the pointer points in different directions. But that's a somewhat different, conceptually, it's a different question from the state before the thing is measured. And necessarily so, because you might want to ask whether the measurement is actually good measure, all right? Which case you better be able to describe both. And so what I'm starting on here, although I haven't, the boring rule applies no matter how big this system is. So this could include measuring apparatus. But I'm emphasizing that it doesn't have to. I'm applying it to systems of any size.
So when you say not measurement of the 5OK, you mean not measurement outcome associated with the 5OK.
Correct. Von Neumann's picture, you know, something comes along and then it's measured by the external machine and certain probabilities. And the attitude I'm taking is it's a closed system, no external machines coming in because it is closed. And this is a probability. So this is how it's done. Okay. As was already noted, the Born probabilities depend on the basis. And it's helpful to go through an example to show that quite explicitly. So let's take the simplest example, a spin half particle. I take zero Hamiltonian, that is the time development operator is trivial. In other words, if it starts off in a particular state at t0, then the Schrodinger unitary time evolution puts it in the same state, that's up t1. If we use the SC basis at time t1, we started off with z plus, that spin in the plus z direction. Then we conclude that with probability 1 at time t1, the one we refer to the time, we have z plus, and the probability is 0, that we get z minus. So that's something that's doesn't bother me. The next one may bother people, so it's use the SX basis. Here we have x plus and x minus, and I ask for the probabilities, and in this case, they turn out to be equal to 1/2. And then I go and say this again, as we first look at the properties of the particle and not the measurement outcome. Okay, maybe the measurement outcome I can discuss later, but at the present time, we're dealing with particle properties. The bases are incompatible, you cannot assign probability to SE equals 1/2 and SX equals minus 1/2 of that at times T1 because those are in compatible. Now, at this stage, I make a remark about what is, to me, a very misleading picture of a spin hat party. Because our imaginations are, let's say, classical, which arise out of the world we're familiar with, we naturally adopt classical images of quantum objects. I don't think we can do otherwise. And the point is not to be too misled by it. So to try and choose images which are, you know, sort of pushing you in the right direction and not pushing you in the wrong direction. For years, I used a very bad image. And the image was to say that when I think of a spin hat particle that spin up, it's imaged this way. And what I have in mind, as I'm sure is in your minds too, is, you know, the picture of a spinning gyroscope with its axis along the plus z direction. I think that's misleading, and I think even with classical images, one can do a lot better. If you look at the older books on atomic physics, you'll find that they never draw things that way. They always tilt this thing, right? And that for very good reason. Because they know that for spin a half, that for instance, the z component may be plus a half, but somehow the total angular momentum is much bigger. Okay, that's why they have these sort of tilting pictures. And I have found it exceedingly helpful to abandon this gyroscope with its axis pointed up, and instead let the axis of the gyroscope be in some random direction. However, you happen to know that the z component, now this is the classical z component, the classical z component is plus half. But you're not committed on the other components. And that's of some importance when you come to this particular application where you say this second base solar, x plus and x minus. We started off with z plus, we end up with x plus and x minus with probability 1/2. Now, if you're careless about this, what your thinking says is, look, we started with this gyroscope axis up, okay? There's no torque, no magnetic field, and a little time later, it's either this way or it's this way. A great mystery. How did it move when there is no torque? If, on the other hand, you have this image where the axis is in some random direction, you don't know which, and at time t naught, you know what the z component is, then at time t1, that x component you can predict with some probability is not quite so mind-blowing. It sort of takes out, I think, one source of error. So I recommend this. Got the question?
Would you recommend the image to the further point that it changes the means in which it rotates, or do you think that's the limit of the analogy?
Means in which?
Well, okay, when you talk about a pointer in a random direction, do you actually have an image rotating or still?
I actually have it still.
Okay.
Now here, of course, the atomic physics folks probably always have it rotating. You of course have to choose your classical voice. I'm trying to be wrong. assure it. But sometimes I think one can do better than other times. I've actually seen points in the literature where people have thought about, in terms of Stern-Gerlach experiments, the spin actually changing direction in this gyroscope sense, and misinterpretation. And that's a sort of misinterpretation, which I think one can avoid by changing the image. Now, let me continue on with the probabilities. Because there's a feature in the Born rule which is not typically pointed out in the textbooks, and I think is extremely important, and the heading of the slide is pre-probability. Before I wrote my book, I didn't use this term. And it was only after I became aware of how various people were misunderstanding the consistent histories approach that I put it in, because, you know, it took me a while to figure out what was going wrong. But the idea here is okay, what is the Born probability? The Born probability, it's probability of this, so probability of something at a later time, given something at an earlier time. So the ontological reference is to the possibilities represented by the orthonormal cases, and of course, the initial state. Now, we calculated my means of this formula. This formula can be rewritten in a variety of different ways. The most common way of rewriting it is the following. You take psi naught, your initial psi naught, and you integrate Schrodinger's equation up to time one, and you call that result psi one. And then you say the probability of phi k1 given psi naught is the inner product of phi k1 psi 1 absolute volume squared. Now, this is a very efficient way of calculating Born probabilities, much better than the way I'm about to show it. But it's not the unique, it's not a unique way. The second way is you can actually integrate Schrodinger's equation backwards from t1 to t0. Here I've done it using the time development operator with the arguments in reverse order. And you see, starting with each phi k1, I get a phi k0. And the resulting the probability that I'm after is then given by this in a product here. Those two expressions are the same. And they are equally good ways of calculating the Born probability if you're not after questions of efficiency. Their relationship to each other is similar to using different gauges for electromagnetic calculations. Then the point I want to make is that so far as we are dealing with probabilities assigned to quantum mechanics, the physical reality is represented by a psi naught and one of these possible bases. Yes? Psi 1, which was the time integral forwards of psi naught, and the phi k naught, which your time integral backwards of the phi k 1, are simply tools. We use them as tools for calculating the Born probabilities. They, however, do not represent the physics. This is the key point I want to try and get across, is that in the history, there's a lot of confusion, in my opinion, in quantum mechanics between wave functions used as representing physical states, properties of a system, and wave functions which are simply used to do calculations. Now, either of these is perfectly good, but confusing them gives trouble. And therefore, in my book, I introduce the notion of a pre-probability. Pre-probability is a tool for computing probability, not the physical reality. Yes?
This only makes sense to me if psi 0 is picked out, because you assume it's associated with the outcome of some measurement at time 0, which gave an eigenvalue associated with psi 0. And that's why we can attribute it to physical reality, because it's measured. But if otherwise time 0 is not distinguished, then why is time 0 physically significant but not other times before that is 0?
You need to distinguish here between a mathematical description of physical reality and the ways in which you would check it experimentally, either by preparation, which you're just going to go through, or the measurement. I'm not saying that the preparation and measurement are unimportant. I am saying that conceptually we can cut them off. And that in this respect, consistent histories is very much anti-classical, unclassical, right? Anti-19th century. But in one respect, in certain respects, it's closer to classical physics than what you typically find in quantum foundations. We are willing to talk about properties of microscopic systems not measured or predicted. That is, isn't that what's bothering? Isn't that what's bothering?
What distinguishes time zero in this picture?
Time zero and non-relativistic physics is simply convenient label. I mean, if I were discussing this in classical terms, would you have any difficulty?
Yeah, we might not say psi 0 is a free probability and psi minus 1 is the difference between reality.
Now that's there is a point which I will get to and emphasize in my next lecture that in doing quantum mechanics in this scheme you have a lot of choice in deciding what you want to talk. Okay? There's a freedom to choose a basis. There's also a freedom back and sign off. Those choices are there, and they are very unintuitive, both for people brought up from classical physics and brought up from the standard quantum stuff. So I will be hitting that point in due course. But it's because I've decided to discuss this situation or the physical situation in this way that I have picked a particular psi naught and then chosen phi 1. What do you do when you get to the termination time?
We clap and ask questions.
And anybody should feel free to leave at this point. Like we hit the canonical hour, I will stick around and answer questions. But I don't want to keep people.
Let's do that cycle then.
Alright, so you said if I make a good measurement that I'm revealing something that's already there. Okay, so suppose I build an apparatus and I have a spin half particle at the top of the one. And I have a measurement, some device that measures the spin up or down along some axis. I can set it to two different measuring devices. I can only activate one so that I can't make any type of measurement. But I can choose which to activate randomly so that I can measure SZ or I can measure SX.
Right.
And I'll find that when I measure one, I see something. But I don't know which I'm going to see until I randomly choose right before I measure which device is going to go off. Now, it seems to me that's very inconsistent with the idea that. The only way I can tell is to say that by choosing a basis state, I'm saying which is existing beforehand, but how is the case if I choose my basis state right before I measure it?
Let me respond in the following way. What you're saying is really very analogous to my double slit with the delayed choice, right? Because maybe I let the secret out, all right? Now, the double slit, or coming coherently through, is like SZ. For spin that particle, or SX. SX equals half. And where it's coming through the top slit is SC equals plus one, and the bottom slit is SC equals minus. That's an analogy.
Sure.
And so that thing is sitting there, and I will address that in some detail in my coming lecture. And I will tell you how I handle those particular things. So if you're willing to be patient, I would say let's put it off, or wait for other questions here and then.
No, it's a long answer. I mean, you're playing.
Yeah. It takes more than 5 seconds. Yes.
This is quite likely related. I don't know how strongly. So you deny the possibility of hidden variables.
Yes.
And you also say here that the wave function is not the state of the system. So, is there a state of the system?
Okay, let me clarify that last one. The wave function can either represent the state of the system in as a physical state, an ontological state, or it can be a calculational tool. Now, let me take this word state, which is a troublesome. If you do classical statistical mechanics, as I used to do, then we have a habit of referring to a probability distribution as a state. Sort of odd terminology. But if you think of the pre-probability, the wave function in terms of a pre-probability, as a state in the sense of a classical probability distribution, then that is the way in which state is called. but there are two very distinct uses of state here, and I hope this, because this is a, this is one of the serious conceptual which really, you know, comes, I believe, is intrinsic to the communist values and the critics of consistent history, so it's a really central issue, this got this issue.
So, would it be accurate to say that this is, not only do you suppose that randomness is inherent in the mechanics, but that this is a statistical approach?
What is the difference?
I'm not sure I could answer. I have an idea of it, but I'm not sure it's forced.
My viewpoint is that as a quantum dynamics is intrinsically stochastic. Right, so and as soon as that happens, basically I am forced to a statistical or probabilistic description of the problem. I have no other option. Your question, Alan?
Yeah, you said that this is a local theory.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how you therefore go about refuting conclusions drawn from Bell's model.
Again, I take the option of putting you off to lecture two, where I devote a significant amount of time. And I think I will have time to get it to eat me up, right? So we're really going and pull the teeth out of horses, You'll see.
All right.
Other questions? Yes, sir.
Can you come back to
louder.
When you compare the two streets experiments with the experiment in Europe.
The box is in there.
You make the comparison for a world that you place far away from the streets or just next to the streets. And what happens when you put the world in between?
Okay, the question is, in doing the comparison with the Mach sample, I was sort of making a clean distinction between having the detectors right next to the slits and far away, and you're asking what about if they're sort of in the intermediate region. Yeah. The situation there is that it's a bit like somebody was raising the question whether you can get almost orthogonal or this kind of raised. Questions of this sort come up. As soon as there is a significant interference effect, then I would say that. I will get to it next time, and probably be better able to address it then. The conclusion is that if I assign a definite detector trigger here or a definite particle position, I cannot say which slit it goes through. That would be incompatible, but on the basis of something I have yet to discuss. And if the detectors are close enough so there's significant interference effect, the incompatibility will still be there. Does that help out? I invite you back next time. And when I think things will be a little clearer, because I'll go through how I think about the double slit and considering it. Yes.
So are the probabilities now, there are some certain probabilities now fundamental constant problem. Like if you have something in SX up and you measure SA, it's 1/√2 some sort of new fundamental constant, or is it derivable?
I think what you're saying is, are the Born probabilities axiomatic? The Born rule. Yeah. The Born yes. In the consistent history system, you can view it as based on certain axioms, and I would not put the Born rule specifically as an axiom simply because it's part of a bigger axiom. It turns out to be a particular case of the axiom for assigning probabilities to closed dynamical systems. But I think your question is right on target. If you're saying, is there an axiom? Is there a physical law? Yes. Does that answer your question?
And there's no way to try it. Like, it's just, or is
it? I don't discourage, look, physics has often advanced by people deriving things which others thought, you know, were just had to postulate as a law. Consider general relativity. It gave us a great advance over Newtonian gravity. And therefore, you can always hope that there's something more to be derived. The present state of it is, I don't know how to derive anything more. But I wouldn't discourage people from looking for these things.
Is there a set of fundamental probabilities then that you can build up anything else you want to look at?
In a way, yes. But let me introduce consistency the next time, and then you'll see the sort of structure. Is that it on the question?
I guess that's it for today.
Okay.